listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
Here we all work along the Mississippi. Here we all work while the white folk play. Pulling them boats from the dawn till sunset. Getting no rest till the judgment day. Don't look up and don't look down. You don't dast make the white boss frown. Bend your knees and bow your head and pull that rope until you're dead. Let me go away from the Mississippi. Let me go away from the white man boss. Show me that stream called the River Jordan. That's the old stream that I long to cross. Old man river, that old man river, he must know something. He don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling. He keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton, and them what plants them is soon forgotten. But old man river just keeps on rolling along.
Well, we're rolling right along here on the New American Dream radio show, hoping we won't be forgotten too soon. Actually, it'd be fine for you to forget us if you remember what we say. Actually, it would be fine for you to forget what we say if things were to change so that people would start caring about each other more than themselves. If people would start caring about other people more than they cared about money. If people would start showing love instead of hate to the world and make peace instead of war, well, you know, if all those things were to happen, well, we'd be happy to forget about having to say it because you'd be doing it. But in the meantime, we'd like you to remember those things. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we're streaming live from Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's a listener-supported network, and we'd love to have you head over to freedomslips.com and buy something or kick in a donation to keep this show and all the others on the air. Lorraine and I went to see American Sniper today, and we walked out. It was boring. It was full of hate and war, gung-ho nationalism. It just about made me sick until I fell asleep. I really wanted to give this thing a chance despite all the controversy, but just couldn't hack it. That's about all I've got for now. I'm proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome back special guests Albert Rousseau, Julius Alafong, Jonathan Mark, and Phil Ferrugio. And so tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Port Orange, in Cameroon, in Paris, somewhere in western Massachusetts, and wherever you are. The Oscar Awards in American Sniper will be a part of the cultural landscape for a few weeks yet, until it forever joins Karate Dog, Hot Tub Time Machine, and Caddyshack 3 on the bottom shelf of the movie rental section of the Chipson Gas in Coonhead, Georgia. Here are some comments on the movie I found that you won't find on Good Morning America for some reason. American Sniper lionizes the most despicable aspects of U.S. society, the gun culture, the blind adoration of the military, the belief that we have an innate right as a Christian nation to exterminate the lesser breeds of the earth, a grotesque hyper-masculinity that banishes compassion and pity, a denial of inconvenient facts and historical truth, and a belittling of critical thinking and artistic expression. Many Americans, especially white Americans, trapped in a stagnant economy and a dysfunctional political system, yearn for the supposed moral renewal and rigid militarized control the movie venerates. These passions, if realized, will extinguish what is left of our now anemic open society. Heroes don't participate in invasions of countries, participating in the murder of millions of innocent people. I certainly will not waste my time watching a film glorifying a mass murderer. According to the review of the movie, there seems to be general agreement that U.S. troop snipers, death squad CIA mercenaries are paid by our tax dollars to enjoy randomly murdering, raping, maiming, and torturing defenseless people. The disagreement is that half of U.S. citizens view those who commit such atrocities as heroes. The other half of us view them as cowardly, grossly misguided, psychopathic lowlifes. Truth is stranger than fiction. A brutal serial killer returns to be undone by one of his own. The soldier who fancies himself a sheepdog has an infantile understanding of the role. The sheepdog, like the sheep, is also the master's property. The dog's purpose in life is to obey its master and protect the master's property. The dog works on command to keep the master's property intact. The dog is not protecting the sheep or their rights as living creatures. It is protecting the property of its master. The sheepdog, when commanded, herds the sheep to the transport that will take them to slaughter. As long as the sheepdog is incapable of independent thought, it can take pride in how well it protects the master's property, but it is a stretch to claim it has the rights of a sheep that are being protected, or the Constitution of the United States, which has been violated by every act of war since World War II. I agree that the film and its appeal are symptomatic of a putrid fascist current in U.S. culture that the corporations and bankers are channeling. The real life, Kyle, as the film was in production, was shot dead at a shooting range near Dallas on February 2, 2013, along with a friend, Chad Littlefield. Poetic justice. Hallelujah. We have again received word from Randall from Stevens Point. He has made his way from the Ukraine to Ferguson, to the Sydney chocolate shop, to the Canadian Parliament, to the kosher deli in Paris, to the Hollywood Hills. He is now positioned flat on his stomach behind the Hollywood sign in the Santa Monica Mountains, overlooking Hollywood, Los Angeles, sighting down the barrel of his granddaddy's 30-06.
I got my gun and my truck. Told you I'm headed for the woods and up the mountain. That's where I am right now. I can see y'all from right here through my scope. Don't worry, I got the safety on. Okay, it's on now. Tell Bubba Jean I always loved her. Don't follow me. I got on my camo jeans. You'd never find me. When you hear about that big shootout and all that, that'll be me. Randall from Stevens Point is now underground in America. Before he gets started with the standard ultimatum document manifesto, he wanted us to again relay this message. First, I got something to say to my relatives in Baraboo. I'm really not talking to any of you, because you know why. Randall's note continues. Once again, the justification is to keep us safe. Safe from what? From the people over there who are angry over what the troops are doing over there. The more people the troops kill and maim, the angrier people get, the greater the threat of terrorist retaliation, greater the need to keep us safe, the greater the infringements on our freedom and well-being that troops have convinced themselves that they're over there killing the people who would otherwise be coming over here to kill us. That's ridiculous. If people wanted to come over here to kill us, they could as easily circumvent the troops and come over here and kill us. Fact is, ever since 9/11 and even before, the troops, through their killing, torturing, maiming, and destroying, have been creating the very danger that U.S. officials have been using to destroy our freedom and well-being here at home. I've got an idea. Let's bring all the troops home from overseas and see what happens. After all, isn't defense supposed to be defense? Switzerland believes in defense, and their troops remain home defending the Swiss people. Interestingly, they also aren't being attacked by angry terrorists. I say let's copy the Swiss model on defense. Let's bring all the troops right home and have them defend America from the people that U.S. officials claim are coming to get us. The troops would end up being totally bored. Americans would quickly learn that no one is coming to get them any more than anyone is going to Switzerland to get the Swiss. That would mean there would be no more justification for the NSA, the CIA, the military-industrial complex, and the entire national security state, and their destruction of American liberty through their embrace of communist-like apparatuses and programs. Instead, there would be no more reason for out-of-control warfare state spending, borrowing, and taxing, all of which are also destroying our country. And now, it's again time for our one-minute hate. Rumsfeld, Rove, Obama, Clinton, Bush, Cheney, Rice, Wolfowitz, Biden. Resistance is victory. To try is to win. Rumsfeld, Rove, Obama, Clinton, Bush, Cheney, Rice, Wolfowitz, Biden. Resistance is victory. Fight them. To try is to win. Drone murders, anthrax, Fox News, NPR, CBS, NBC, ABC. Resistance is victory. Fight them. To try is to win. Je suis Hiroshima. Je suis Wellstone. Je suis Oklahoma City. Je suis Fallujah. Je suis Nagasaki. Je suis Waco. Je suis Wounded Knee.
Our first guest of the night is Albert Rousseau. Albert will be speaking to us live from Paris, France. And Chuck, I'll just go through as much of his bio as I can here, and when I hear him answer, I'll be quiet. Albert Rousseau has published worldwide over 85 books of poetry, fiction, and photography in English and in French, his two mother tongues, is recipient of many awards, such as the American Society of Writers Fiction Award, the British Diversity Short Story Award, several New York Poetry Forum Awards, Amelia Prose and Poetry Awards, and the Prix Colette, among others. His work has been translated into a dozen languages, including German, Italian, Spanish,
Hello, Greek, Chuck. Turkish.
Hello, Albert. Welcome to the show. You are live on the air.
That's right. Hello, Chuck, and hello to all my American friends. It's still time to say Happy New Year with health, love, and also success. That will help. Of course, as you all know, we had a horrific beginning here in France. So now I shall read you a few poems, a variety of poems, and with also a surprise for you. The surprise is a few French songs, since I'm here in Paris. And so you'll have the poems in English and the songs in French. I'm starting now with a haiku sequence, The Stages of Love. Diaphanous blue, cloven by the Eiffel Tower in your virgin space. A veil of dust draping my body, the sound of your breath. Iridescent dot sucked into a chalice, flower tongues, ladybug. The moment your lips meet, you can kiss friendship goodbye. The flesh takes over. Skin against skin, and the magic operates till the cells rebel. The difference between a sex maniac and a lover, body temperature. Beware, dear lovers, passion is a clash of wills, bound to implode. He fell in love with her, but she looked elsewhere, smitten his heart, a gaping wound. And here comes the song. Bella, 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 ooh, Bella, ooh, Bella, ooh, Bella, ooh, Bella. Elle répondait au nom de Bella. Les gens du coin ne voulaient pas lâcher là. Elle faisait trembler tous les villages. Les gens me disaient, méfie-toi cette fille-là. Elle répondait au nom de Bella. Les gens du coin ne voulaient pas lâcher là. Elle faisait trembler tous les villages. Les gens me disaient, méfie-toi cette fille-là. C'était un phénomène, elle n'était pas humaine. Le genre de femme qui change le plus grand de la grande gentleman. Une beauté sans pareil, tout le monde de s'en emparer sans savoir qu'elle aimait en bateau. On pouvait tout donner, elle n'avait qu'à demander. Puis aussitôt on démarrait, on cherchait à l'impressionner, à devenir son préféré sans savoir qu'elle aimait nos bâtons. Mais quand je la vois danser le soir, j'aimerais devenir la chaise sur laquelle elle s'assoit. Pour moins que ça, un moins que rien, juste une pierre sur son chemin. Elle répondait au nom de Bella. Les gens du groupe ne voulaient pas lâcher là. Elle faisait trembler tous les villages. Les gens me disaient, méfie-toi cette fille-là. Elle répondait au nom de Bella. Les gens du groupe ne voulaient pas lâcher là. So, have you heard this?
No, I had never heard that before.
Okay, so was it clear?
Oh, yes.
Okay, the next poem is a bit of a sad poem, since I lost my mother a year and a half ago, and of course I miss her terribly. It's called To Cry and to Laugh. The heart is in tatters, yet all you see on my face is a sparrow-like grin. That darling person who has given birth to me is my life, my soul. She can't help frowning, her forehead a parchment of untold suffering. She closes her eyes as if to discard my pain and cracks a joke. I don't tell her she's lost so much weight, I want to cry. Oh, how she reads through me, knowing that I cannot take or envisage the worst. Her reality is as clear as it is cruel, yet she mocks it. She tells me to picture her and my dear uncle, who is 99. Two joyful ghosts, she says, no, rather two packs of bones, rattling in a pas de deux. In spite of it all, she gets me into a fit of laughter. Now, I will let you hear this song by, you probably know him, Aznavour. Of course, he's one of the most famous French singers, and it's called La Mama.
Ils sont venus, ils sont tous là, dès qu'ils ont entendu ce cri, elle va mourir là. Ils sont venus, ils sont tous là, même ceux du sud de l'Italie. Il y a même Giorgio, le fils maudit, avec des présents plein les bras. Tous les enfants jouent en silence autour du lit sur le carreau. Mais leurs jeux n'ont pas d'importance, c'est un peu leur dernier cadeau à la maman. On la réchauffe de baisers, on lui remonte ses oreillers, et elle va mourir là. Sainte Marie, pleine de grâce, dont la statue est sur la place, bien sûr, vous lui tendez les bras en lui chantant Ave Maria, Ave Maria. Il y a tant d'amour, de souvenirs.
Okay, how long do I still have?
You probably have about between 5 and 6 minutes, maybe six okay. minutes.
Okay. So now I shall read you a poem that reflects what we've just been through. It's called Kristallnacht of the Third Millennium. If you open your history books, you will read about the infamous Kristallnacht the Nazis launched one misty night in November 1938 throughout all the major cities of Germany, whereby Jewish shops, restaurants, and synagogues were vandalized, pillaged, or burned down. This happened before the most monstrous genocide and the greatest butchery in the history of mankind. It is happening all over again here in France, in Paris, in Roubaix, and in many other localities, from the north of the country to the south. This time, the perpetrators are pseudo-Muslim thugs who don't even know a thing about their own religion. And while they perform these criminal acts, they keep shouting, "Death to the Jews! We will wipe you out of Europe!" And they gun down 4 shoppers in a kosher restaurant after having massacred some of France's most talented caricaturists, the so-called blasphemers of Charlie Hebdo. So here's another song for you, in Italian this time. And it's called, I think you know it. It's called, sorry, I have to look for this here. It's called Gloria. Do you know Gloria?
I'll let you know after I hear it.
One second. One second, please. Where is this Gloria? La mamma. Here it is. Okay. And it's by Umberto Tozzi.
All'aria manchi ad una mano che lavora piano, manchi a questa bocca che cibo più non tocca, è sempre questa storia che me la chiamo Gloria, Gloria sui tuoi fianchi, la mattina nasce il sole, entra odio ed esce amore, dal nome Gloria. Gloria, manchi tu nell'aria, manchi come sale, manchi più del sole, sciogli questa neve che soffoca il mio petto.
Okay.
I knew it.
Did you know that one?
Yes, I did.
Uh-huh. Do I have for another poem or no more time?
Well, there's probably not much more time. And I'd like you to let our listeners know about your books and where they can find your books.
Very good. So it's on Amazon. You just Google Albert Russo, R-U-S-S-O. You know, my father was Italian, Italian, as a lot of people say in the States. So Albert Russo, you Google, and you'll see my African Quatuor, African novels, my comical Zappinet series. It's for all ages from 14 to 114.
Well, that's great. I like that. While we still have moments, and anytime now, we're going to hear the music, which lets us know that this segment is over. But while I have you for a moment here,
yes,
can you tell us what the mood is in Paris these days in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo?
Very, very bleak, because we know it's going to happen again and again, but not exactly when. They're such cowards that you never know where and when it's going to happen. In the subway, in a big department store, but you should all know that France is the number one target in Europe, then Great Britain, then Belgium, because we have about 5,000 European Muslims. European Muslims who go to Syria and to Iraq and want to come back here and wreak havoc.
So the general feeling over there is that it actually is Muslims behind this and not false flag
Islamists.
Operation. I'm sorry, we're out of time.
Okay, but, so thanks for everything.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now, the adventures of Mark in his parents' basement, covered in Cheetos dust. He is Conspiracy Theory Man, the man of La Mancha, writing his neighborhood award-winning blog, Cheetos Dust and Moon Dust Are Both Orange. And just so we're clear here, Mark punches the letters on the keyboard covered in tiny, tasty bits, throwing up an orange cloud. In his 2013 book, Conspiracy Theory in America, author Lance DeHaven Smith traced the term conspiracy theory back to a CIA propaganda campaign that was designed to discredit doubters of the Warren Commission's fake search into who assassinated President Kennedy in Dallas. In this light, the use of the pejorative term is obviously a tactic to shame and humiliate those who saw through the ulterior motives of the commission and thus effectively censor out or even banish anyone who questions official government accounts. The Warren Commission, to its eternal shame, ignored the testimony of a multitude of eyewitnesses to the crime that proved that there were shooters both behind and in front of Kennedy's motorcade. Many witnesses, none of whom were called to testify, had heard shots coming from the grassy knoll in front of the motorcade. Anyone with discerning eyes saw JFK's head being violently thrown backwards from the headshot, thus proving that that shot had come from the front, as did the next shot, thus disproving the single shooter theory and proving that the assassination of the president was indeed a conspiracy. Hence the CIA's cunning ploy with the pejorative conspiracy theorist label to discredit those who had taken on as their duty to be skeptical of what was indeed another of the big lies that regularly come from political entities that want our trust and votes, from advertising campaigns, from corporations that want our trust and money, from government and military entities that want our trust and support, and from the for-profit media entities that want our trust and money. All those entities had to be involved in the crime and cover-up of the events of 9/11/01. Both the Warren and 9/11 commissions were in effect saying, hey, you American idiots, listen up. How many times do we have to tell you that this case is closed? We got our crazed lone gunman. Now just be obedient children and resume your shopping, brain-numbing amusements, celebrity worship, and vegetating on the couch, cheering for your favorite professional football, baseball, hockey, or basketball teams. or they may try to reassure us a bit more diplomatically by saying, trust us when we say that those heinous crimes were simply committed by lone gunmen like Lee Harvey Oswald, James Earl Ray, Sirhan Sirhan, Osama bin Laden, or Adam Lanza, despite all the evidence to the contrary. And those cases have been neatly wrapped up by hook or by crook. So just move on. There is nothing more to see here. And should you continue to have doubts about our official stories, just be sure to remember what happens. The conscientious whistleblowers like Martin Luther King, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, and Julian Assange, when they go poking around where they're not wanted. There may have been many American military, government, corporate, conspiratorial dirty tricks that were initially denied by the propagandizing powers that be, but which were later admitted to after diligent and courageous whistleblowing investigative journalists proved the conspiracies. In every case, the powers that be had been, in effect, calling the truth seekers conspiracy theorists. My particular daily newspaper is politically and economically very conservative. In its defense, it can be said that its policies are not unlike most of the corporate-owned and corporate-controlled mainstream media outlets when it comes to running away from unwelcome points of view that seem unpatriotic, too progressive, anti-war, or anti-empire. Any information about taboo subjects, if it is printed at all, is muted, placed on the back pages. Censorship abounds. One has to wonder, what motivates a newspaper to willingly become part of a censorship campaign against 9/11 truth seekers that 30 to 40% of Americans, much higher in New York City, know is just cunning propaganda? The evidence that casts doubt or disproves the official theories is so overwhelming that many clear-headed foreigners whose media aren't consciously trying to hide the truth about 9/11 regard us Americans as being idiots or dupes when it comes to 9/11 issues. What if our editors and publishers had been in the newspaper business in Germany in the 1930s? One can't help but wonder what would be the editorial stances of the owners or editors of our mainstream American newspapers if they had time traveled back to the pro-war, pro-empire, racist, fascist, militarized police state that was Germany 70 years ago. Would they have willingly printed Hitler's widely accepted stories, often printed in letters to the editor, that irrationally promoted the imprisoning and extermination of minorities like Jews, Slavs, gypsies, and homosexuals on the basis of the popular pseudoscience of genetic and white racial superiority, which was also popular with white physicians and geneticists in the U.S. during the 1920s? Would our time-traveling newspaper publishers and editors have courageously accused Hitler, his fascist government, and his loyal soldiers of conspiring to start World War II by their blatant false flag attack against Poland on 9/1/39? I think not. The cost of doing good journalism would have been too high for them, and the potential cost of doing good, honest journalism exploring what was obviously a false flag operation, 9/11/01, in order to start a war has apparently been too high as well. The questions above are entirely appropriate for those of us trying to survive in our racist, militarist, corporate-controlled, and morally financially bankrupted American empire, where corrupt crony capitalism is unregulated and ruthless, where the media is under the control of mega-corporations and their assorted sociopathic billionaire owners who don't give a damn about the survivability of the planet, where poverty, economic inequality, oppression, and climate disasters are crushing people everywhere, where the punitive politicians of the far right are trying to achieve total control of all branches of our government, and where a militarized police state is emerging that undemocratically protects excess luxury wealth, the corporate state, and the unaffordable perpetual war machine. What is really scary is the fact that the news and opinion pages of most of America's mainstream newspapers and talk shows are adhering to a similar fear-based blacklisting mentality that raises its ugly head from time to time, most memorably for us in the U.S. during the paranoid, hard right-wing GOP politics of the paranoid McCarthy era, where American fascism prospered for a while and then went temporarily dormant. There is another agenda at work here in the 21st century America, and it isn't democracy in action.
The American Rip Van Winkle woke up on the sofa of the front lounge of the Super 6 in Longmont. The big TV played. He hadn't watched TV in all these years. The giant set covered the whole room with a thick layer of blaring sound. The Good Morning America host smiling about soap bubbles and then scowling about Al-Qaeda and Bob-Qaeda. And the American Rip Van Winkle thought that nothing had changed. Nothing. Not a thing in all those long years.
And now we return to The Adventures of Mark. In his parents' basement, covered in Cheetos dust, he is conspiracy theory man, the man of La Mancha, writing his neighborhood award-winning blog. Cheetos dust and moon dust are both orange.
Jim Fetzer, Kevin Barrett, James Tracy, and before them was Mae Brussell. Brussell had doubts about the official version of the JFK assassination from the moment she watched Jack Ruby assassinate Lee Harvey Oswald on live national television. When Brussell's daughter first saw Oswald in the hallway of the Dallas jail, it was obvious he'd been beaten, and she felt sorry for him. She was wrapping up her teddy bear to send him when they saw Ruby shoot him, because it also bothered Brussell that the newspaper and TV coverage regarding Oswald's background was full of discrepancies and contradictions. In 1964, she paid $86 to purchase the 26-volume Warren Commission report of the Kennedy assassination, which contained even more discrepancies and contradictions. As she stated in a 1974 interview with Playgirl magazine, 23 adjectives were used to describe him in the Warren report. They said he had no friends, no meaningful relationships, couldn't hold a job, and so on. But the evidence all pointed in the opposite direction. So she began a 7-year project to cross-index all the key witnesses and findings, filling dozens of notebooks with 28,000 pages of files on each witness and their specific link to Oswald. What she ultimately discovered was that the International Terror Network had gone underground and were continuing their fascist campaign to take over one country after another, including the U.S. Her determination to dig deeper into the JFK and other assassinations led her to read 15 newspapers every day and subscribe to more than 150 periodicals. The clippings she cut and saved would eventually fill 39 file cabinets. As a result of her careful research, Brussell would conclude that the Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King's assassination, the Manson family murders, Ted Kennedy's Chappaquiddick affair, and the Patty Hearst kidnapping were all orchestrated by the far right, the CIA, the FBI, and the Mafia, with the dual purpose of discrediting the left and establishing a fascist state. Join us next week for another episode of Mark, the Man of La Mancha, when we'll see Mark at a crossroads after seeing some feet and some legs walking past the basement window, wondering whether he should hide from the CIA hit team or, well, maybe take a little nap in the big chair.
Our next guest of the night is Jonathan Mark. Jonathan, we heard from Jonathan the first portion of his segment last week, and Chuck will be getting that line, the second part of Jonathan's interview, lined up right about now. Jonathan has a website Flyby.
Last week we heard for the first time from Jonathan Mark of Flyby News, and he's going to pick up where he left off, which was very interesting, some very interesting information. Will you recount the first three items before you go into the fourth one as far as your important events or anyway, go ahead.
Reported false flag operations to date that has had horrendous consequences and has produced fear as a model for disrupting the peace movement. And the fourth item, which I didn't go into last week, that I'll cover a little bit more in detail, is the moon landing in 1972, the Apollo lunar mission. We produced a lot of evidence showing that that was a fraudulent mission, and which explains why it hasn't repeated in over 45 years. Especially when you talk about 1915 technology, 1959, 1972, to do six missions to reach the moon and come back. Three landed on the moon, they launched off the moon, and you wonder, you know, well, what happened to the space program? They can do that six times in 3 years. Why has Russia never even left low orbit? And why, since that time, nobody from the United States has, an astronaut has gone beyond low orbit? And when they tried in 1994, CNN reported that the astronauts were experiencing radiation bombarding inside their skulls to such a degree that CNN called them solar electrons, and they couldn't figure out how they got to the moon so easily in the 60s. And here it was 94, they had the suit on, they had the bucket gear, they still had this crappy spacecraft that doesn't have enough protection. And it was only 350 miles from the Earth that the radiation forced the mission back down, because they wanted to see how high they can go with the shuttle. And the Van Allen radiation belts get thickest around 1,000 miles and goes at least 25,000 miles in a very high intent. So they weren't even halfway there to the thick part of the radiation. So that could explain why Russia's never tried to send an astronaut through those radiation elements, or we haven't done it since. There's quite a lot of other evidence in that film, as well as my website under the top paragraph. You'll see the key topics listed under it, and you'll see evidence of lunar Apollo fraud. And there you can watch movies with scientists and engineers discussing the fraudulent moon landing and the evidence that so many people are so emotionally attached to, that even though they realize that 9/11 was a false flag operation, and they realize that Kennedy was killed by a shadow government, it's hard for people to or to be skeptical of the official version, even though it's been 45 years since anybody reproduced it, and it all came through a main feed that was controlled by the military, and the media didn't have a direct feed to the and as many evidence as you can show, you'll have debunkers showing the other way. So when you're a 9/11 truth activist and you get all these people telling you that, you know, the government couldn't cover it up, they couldn't do this, they couldn't do that, and look at this and look at that. When you're exposing the moon landing hoax, you can see the same, the 9/11 truthers are saying the same thing that they're told by people that are in denial. And so I encourage people to do the research. It's hard because it's emotionally painful. But once you get to a place, you feel good knowing that there is truth in the world, and even though, you know, you get ridiculed and mistreated for such statements, and you even have people that you trust and like, you know, tell you that you're smart.
I have to ask them, how long will it take for you to get to the issue I just want to bring up the flyby news, because it's very amazing, is one of the big surprises from the Cassini Earth flyby. I was contacted by a scholar, Bart Jordan, who's lectured five different departments at the University of New Hampshire and was a concert classical guitarist who studied under Andre Segovia. He let me know that he worked secretly with NASA since a child, and also with the Manhattan Project, and that he was able to provide them with information that he was able to decipher from ancient languages. So I hope that will pique your interest. It makes sense of why there's pyramids, why there's this, all these evidences of advanced technologies. R. Jordan claims that there was space travel pre-Ice Age times, and that they embedded and left details, and that he was in charge of the Mars Viking mission in 1976 and took pictures of the Cydonia region. And just to give you just a little bit more of an overview, the topics that we cover are basically to wake people up. And we're also covering energy pollution's impact on our environment, and we're supporting a referendum campaign in Massachusetts. Since we tried this with 9/11, to have a Citizens 9/11 Commission in 2011 on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, which failed mostly because of lack of support. I learned a lot from that, and now we're going to be trying to go forward with a referendum to vote to stop a fracked gas pipeline that wants to go through from New York State to the East Coast so they could export it and play their geopolitical games with a fuel that could damage our water, our most precious forests and water systems. So we're covering a bunch of topics, and I just encourage people to come over to flybynews.com for life survival in the 21st century and check us out and help us spread this information around. There's also health blogs and credible witness UFO disclosures and resources for reclaiming our lost USA Republic, as well as special exclusive information on Leonard Peltier and his campaign for freedom. Do you have any questions, Chuck?
I think you've provided a really good summary of some of these things, and I hope that maybe we can get you back on a regular basis to go into some more detail.
Yeah, one at a time.
Yeah, exactly. The space things and the moon, or the questionable story of whether we made it to the moon. That's one that I've been torn on. I've really had trouble knowing what to believe.
Well, I have a pretty good resource section, so you can certainly look at least from the perspective that we're sharing of evidence of fraud. And it's not just Bart Cibrel's movie, which you probably heard of, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon. Have you seen that one?
No, I haven't seen it.
That is a 47-minute movie that I think is must-see, because he did an excellent job in producing this film that's interesting to watch, and it has footage showing NASA's astronauts faking they were outside low orbit, but they were really in low orbit at the time of their faking it. There's actual footage showing that, as well as all the shadow anomalies and the overview of that. But then there's a couple of films called What Happened on the Moon, parts one and part two, with other scientists giving their perspectives. But I just think with Bart Jordan, he's convinced that they couldn't do a lunar landing and launching at that time. And also, if they could, they would have to have cesium clocks on board both crafts in order to find the rendezvous craft that's orbiting, the one that landed, because there's no GPS up there. And when you're in space and those type of speeds, according to Bart Jordan that was involved with NASA, you would need cesium clocks on board both crafts, and they don't really have a way of emitting and using that high technology at this point, besides the intense radiation elements. You know how dangerous it is to be outside our belt? There's no question why no one's done it all this time. And when they just did a recent space mission, they called it, I forget, Orion. They sent it around right into the belt and went around the belt twice and then landed in the ocean. And obviously they were, taking measures and information. There might have been some life on board there, which they won't tell us. There might be some lead shielding to see how that detects life. But you know, there's a lot of good reasons to be questioning it. And it just takes a lot of time because when I started researching it, it took me 5 years of like watching that Sibrel movie I would show publicly and try to get people to respond and discredit it because it was so, you know, intense for me to consider. And the only way that people would respond to it is they would bring up other angles of looking at it. So, you know, whatever they would pull out, they would have a lot of.
Bill Caruggio presents It's the Empire, Stupid.
Good evening, working stiffs. You know, I went into my local bank branch. I have a bunch of people who work there who read my columns, and they're very lovely people. And I went in there, and I wanted to tell them about a movie, which I want to tell you all about. It's the 40th anniversary of the movie Rollerball, okay, directed Norman Jewison's film with James Caan and John Houseman. The original, you must see, it's excellent. So I told them about the movie, and they never heard of it, of course. They're 28 years old, the other one was 30, and the gentleman was about my age. And so I said, well, it's an Orwellian-type film. Who? I said, Orwell. Did you ever hear of George Orwell? No. Did you ever hear of the book, 1984? Weren't you supposed to read that book in high school? No, they never told us to read that book. All right, so that's the story. Here's what Jim Garrison had to say about this topic 50 years ago. What worries me deeply is that we in America are in a great danger of slowly evolving into a proto-fascist state. It's based on power and on the inability to put human goals and human conscience above the dictates of the state. Its origins can be traced in the tremendous war machine we built since 1945, the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower vainly warned us about, which now dominates every aspect of our life. The power of the states and Congress has gradually been abandoned to the executive department because of war conditions, and we've seen the creation of an arrogant, swollen bureaucratic complex totally unfettered by the checks and balances of the Constitution. In a very real and terrifying sense, our government is the CIA and the Pentagon, with Congress reduced to a debating society. Said this 50 years ago. Of course, you can't spot this trend to fascism by casually looking around. You can't look for such familiar signs as a swastika because they won't be there. We won't build Dachau's and Auschwitz's. The clever manipulation of the mass media is creating a concentration camp of the mind that promises to be far more effective in keeping the populace in line. We're not going to wake up one morning and suddenly find ourselves in gray uniforms goose-stepping off to work. But this isn't the test. The test is, what happens to the individual who dissents? In Nazi Germany, he was physically destroyed. Here, the process is more subtle, but the end results can be the same. Now, I've always had a kind of knee-jerk trust in my government's basic integrity, whatever political blunders it may make. But I've come to realize that in Washington, deceiving and manipulating the public are viewed by some as the natural prerogatives of office. Dewey Long once said, fascism will come to America in the name of anti-fascism. I'm afraid, based on my own experience, that fascism will come to America in the name of national security. We're working stiffs. Can you see that this was 50 years ago? That Jim Garrison said this. The movie Rollerball talks about a corporate world, not countries, but corporations, and how this game, Rollerball, this violent, terribly violent game, is loved by the majority of the populace in the world, and how one man, a hero, actually he's not a hero, he's a star player, is too powerful for the game and they need to get rid of him. You must see the movie, you must read 1984 by George Orwell, and you must tell all those younger people that we all know who never heard of 1984, never heard of George Orwell, to stop, take off their whatever they wear in their ears, their music things and their gadgets, go to a library, take out the book, or go to Kindle, get the book, 1984, read it, go see the original movie Rollerball, and find out what is happening now that movies like American Sniper are so popular, where they should be panned and boycotted by the general populace. Thank you, and good night.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Now for your local Earth news. Hello, everyone. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polacek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard.
Apple Valley, Minnesota. The project leader of the controversial film Gray State, along with his wife and daughter, were found dead in their home in what authorities have labeled an apparent murder-suicide. The bodies of David Crowley, 29, his wife Comel, 28, and their 5-year-old daughter were discovered lying in their home by a neighbor. The Crowley family had not been seen since before Christmas, and neighbors assumed that they were on an extended vacation. Neighbor Colin Prochnow said he grew concerned when packages piled up on the couple's doorstep and he heard a dog barking inside. When he looked in the window on the morning of January 18, 2015, the grim discovery was made. It was reported that the bodies appeared to have been inside for weeks before being discovered. Christmas lights were still illuminated. Presents were left unopened under the Christmas tree. Mr. Prush now told CARE 11 News that he never heard any yelling, never heard any screaming, a husband and wife fight, or anything like that. One neighbor told CBS News that the Crowleys were a picture-perfect family. A statement from the Apple Valley Police Department called it an apparent murder-suicide. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the Dakota County Sheriff's Office are assisting with the investigation and told the Daily Mail that they're treating the death as suspicious. David Crowley was an Iraq War veteran, was known for his work on an original film entitled Gray State. The yet-to-be-released film depicts the impending financial collapse of the United States, a declaration of martial law, and a brutal crackdown on civil liberties in the United States. Crowley was the writer and director of the film. In collaborations with Police State USA on the project, Crowley described Gray State as a film about the dystopian horror we face should we, as a nation, fail to embrace liberty. According to musician Jordan Page, a friend of David Crowley, the film was about to start production with a $30 million budget from a major Hollywood studio. In the wake of the deaths, Crowley's colleagues wrote that the future of Gray State is uncertain. Please understand, we are all in complete shock by having lost a great friend.
That's all, folks. That's the news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck, and so it goes. Stay classy, San Diego. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. At the end of the day, it is what it is. Have a good day. Bring something to the table, and always remember to tip your congressman. Our next guest of the evening is Julius Alafong. Julius speaks to us as often as he can, every few months or so, from Cameroon. Yaoundé, I think, is the pronunciation of where Julius is, the capital of Cameroon. And Chuck will get that recording lined up right about now.
Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Mike, for giving me the opportunity once more to appear on the New American Dream radio show. Cameroon is good. Africa is okay and we are doing just fine, except for terrorism carried out by Boko Haram on Cameroon that is making life so difficult for some of us around here. I would really like to talk on terrorism this time around because this is really the topic of the day. Even though with the African Nations Cup going on, the threat imposed on some of us by the Boko Haram terrorist movement is leaving no stone unturned. Some of the events that have been happening around here start with Boko Haram, and there have been, or we could take some highlight on what happened in Paris on the Wednesday, 7th of January 2015, when the Kouachi brothers, who are professed Muslims, jihadists, entered the Charlie Hebdo's newsroom in Paris and killed 12 journalists. We also had another jihadist, Ahmed Koulibaly, who entered a Jewish supermarket in Paris and killed 4 other people. Suddenly, we saw the birth of this slogan, Je suis Charlie, that is in French, which literally in English will mean I am Charlie, referring to the newspaper organ, the satirist caricature newspaper organ called Charlie Hebdo. You know, Charlie Hebdo is this newspaper organ that some time ago caricatured Muhammad. And you know, Muslims don't really like their prophet being drawn in pictures or being caricatured. So this is what must have caused this jihadist, this professed Muslim jihadist, to enter the Charlie Hebdo's headquarters in Paris and kill the 12 journalists. Nevertheless, we saw many African head of state join other 50 world leaders and François Hollande, the president of France, in a solidarity march in Paris to denounce terrorism. And so many millions of sympathizers, as we are told, accompanied them in this march past. The presence of some African leaders was described by some Africans, including myself, as being ridiculous. This is because Boko Haram has claimed so many lives in Nigeria and Cameroon, about 2,000 combined. We know what is taking place in Central Africa. We know what is taking place in Libya with people being killed every day. And we've never seen any solidarity march against this barbaric act. And not even a helping hand from some of these countries of the world which are qualified as developed. But however, do not misunderstand us. We do not mean that we want to condone with the killings of human beings in Paris. No, we don't do that. But we simply want to observe from another approach, which seems like the lives of the white man or the white man is far more important than that of a black man or that of Africans, especially when we take into consideration the fact that 17 people are killed and the whole world rallies in Paris against that. But 2,000 people are killed, 240 schoolgirls were kidnapped in Chibok in Nigeria, and we don't see any rally. We don't see people going against that. I mean, it raises some doubt, you know. Whatever the case, I think we only have ourselves to be blamed. I mean, we Africans, we have to blame ourselves because it looks like we undermine ourselves and our own brothers and sisters who are being killed every day by these terrorists. And not the only terrorists. We have diseases, we have poverty, we have road accidents, and nobody seems to say anything about that. And really, it's something to denounce. However, let's go on a more positive note. The fight against Boko Haram by the Cameroon soldier saw the freeing of a German hostage who was abducted some 6 months ago in Nigeria by Boko Haram. This made Cameroon appear tall and big in the international scene. I mean, that's a plus for us. The sub-region, I mean the African sub-region, with its organization called the Economic Community of Central African State, made up of 10 countries, have discussed last Wednesday with President Paul Biya of Cameroon to see how they're going to mobilize more troops to help support the Cameroonian troops in the fight against Boko Haram in the north of Cameroon. If we were to look into the reasons why Boko Haram is back on the Cameroonian soil, I mean, why they are into the Cameroonian soil, we can understand that this movement is trying to link with other rebellion movements in Chad and in Central Africa, so as to put in place a veritable force of destruction and destabilization of the sub-region. But I don't think the state has to allow this happen. But Boko Haram's attack on Cameroon is facing a fierce riposte from the Cameroonian army. Boko Haram thought that since they could defeat the Nigerian army, with Nigeria being considered as the powerhouse of Africa, because Nigeria is the most populated African nation and has so many soldiers, Boko Haram has really threatened the Nigerian military. And they thought that with that, they could easily crush the Cameroon. But they forgot one thing, you know. When we analyze conflict, Boko Haram is a Nigerian movement. Boko Haram is born in Nigeria. Boko Haram is cardinally made of Nigerian citizens who are recalcitrant, who are rebellious against the Nigerian system. Now, Boko Haram fighting in Nigeria stage what we call an intra-conflict. That's a conflict amongst the citizens of the same country. Now, with such conflict, it is a little difficult because we don't know who is who, and some people share the sympathy. But once Boko Haram crosses into Cameroon, it leaves the connotation of an intra-conflict and now becomes an inter-conflict. That is, we consider it, or the Cameroon considers such conflict as an external assault that is attacking a foreign land. And it is normal that Cameroon will put all its force, all its people will rally behind its soldiers to fight and kick out such invaders. But Boko Haram's threat on Cameroon has caused some sympathy or some solidarity from some African nations. The African Union has put in its own voice. Russia, Chad, China, as well as Germany, have pledged to support the Cameroon's military in fighting against Boko Haram. They are going to contribute in technical and human resources. And we are very happy about that. But we know that in the world today we have two movements, I mean, that are really preoccupying us. We have the Boko Haram in Africa and the ISIS in the Middle East, in Iraq, in Syria, and Damascus, if you to say so. Now, we see with ISIS, we have discovered that, now I'm just being strategic, I'm just being an international relationist, if I could say so, or an analyst, what is happening at the international scene. We've been saying, looking at the point where we can now observe counter-alliances, with the USA teaming up with Syria and Iran to join fight against ISIS. But this is important to know that terrorism leaves no one safe, you know. When it comes to a transnational menace like terrorism, the state is not safe. No sovereignty is respected and all territories are violated. So we want to say that when it comes to such a menace, states have to put aside their interest and put together their forces to fight a common enemy. Just like the Western world are forming controversial alliances to conquer ISIS, in Africa, regional states, the AU, as well as friends of Cameroon, although we all know that some international relations, especially the realist theory, hold that in international relations there is no friendship. However, we appreciate the fact that some of these states are putting their efforts together to eradicate Boko Haram weighing on Cameroon and Nigeria, because if they don't do so, we don't know to the next stage. We don't know the next stage that it's going to take. We don't know the next country that it's going to disturb or destabilize. It can even go above Africa. So I think it's a good thing for us to join our forces and fight terrorism wherever we find ourselves. Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Mike, once again for giving me this opportunity, and I hope to chip in again next month. Thank you, and stay blessed. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Julius. I know that Julius is listening, so he can't talk to me, but I can talk to Julius. I want to say thank you for being with us every once in a while over, I don't know how long it's been, probably at least a year, maybe it's been 2 years, but we really appreciate you taking the time to send your recordings to us. And it's important because, you know, we would never know, or I would never know what, you know, what's going on in Cameroon. I had to look on a map online to find out where Cameroon is. And now I know where it is. And by listening to you, I learn a little bit more. And I don't know much about Boko Haram. And I also want to say that, you know, and with our two guests, Julius Alafong and Albert Rousseau, we're able to hear people who are on the ground, who are up close and personal at where these things are happening, Boko Haram, and also with Albert Rousseau in Paris. And while we don't hear much about Boko Haram on U.S. news, and we did for a while, but we don't anymore. But we do hear about Paris, and in listening to Albert, I guess I have we asked him, you know, what is the mood in Paris, and he said that people in Paris are very much afraid because there are many Muslim people in Paris. So that leads me to believe that he believes that it was Muslims who did the shooting, and that it was all true as well as is portrayed on the TV. And I have to say that I don't believe that. I don't believe that Albert Rousseau, sorry, but I don't think you know what's really going on. I don't think you know that, you know, what's happening right in front of you. It was a false flag. And then if you have to go to the internet to research, you cannot just read a newspaper, because it's really the ISIS and Boko Haram and Paris, it's the CIA, it's the NSA. And that's what I think it is. And, you know, if you go to the internet, you see the videos, they're shooting at a policeman, there is no blood. His head does not, and he was shooting blanks. And But what we can see by hearing from Albert is that the false flag did what it was supposed to do. They fooled even an educated man as Albert Rousseau into thinking that they're under fire from Muslims, and that's really what all this is about. You know, we're here on this radio show to seek the truth, and we do need to hear from everyone, but we don't need to accept what we hear if we know that. That's something, you know, we've done some studying, and we've seen that the truth is not as is commonly portrayed or commonly believed. And I just have to say that. And thank you. Now, please join us for another episode of The American on the Hot Sidewalk, holding up a tin can and a sign in the middle of the city. The American on the Hot Sidewalk, holding up a tin can and a sign in the middle of the city, looked up and squinted at somebody staring down at him, holding up his can in one hand and his sign in another. He tries to make his signs humorous, something about how his family was kidnapped by ninjas and now he needs money for karate lessons. But today's sign says, the poor go to prison, the rich go to hell. And this person right here isn't smiling. The American on the hot sidewalk holding up a tin can and a sign in the middle of the city looked away from the not smiling person in the sun and rested his head back against the brick wall yet again. He closed his eyes and went to his happy place. Sometimes that was the Dairy Queen in Ocala. Sometimes it was riding a horse with his father near Cumberland. Sometimes it was other things. He went there. He came back. He squinted his eyes against the sun to see if he was still being watched. The American on the hot sidewalk holding up a can and a sign in the middle of the city held up his sign to block the sun and kept reading the book he held on the back side of the sign. And in the eyes of the people, there is the failure. And in the eyes of the hungry, there is a growing wrath. In the souls of the people, the grapes of wrath are filling and growing heavy for the vintage.
One man, one family driven from the land, this rusty car creaking along the highway to the west. I lost my land. A single tractor took my land. I am alone and bewildered. And in the night, one family camps in a ditch, and another family pulls in and the tents come out. The two men squat on their hands and the women and children listen. Here is the node, you who hate change and fear revolution. Keep these two squatting men apart. Make them hate, fear, suspect each other. Here is the analogy of the thing you fear. This is the zygote. For here, I lost my land is changed. A cell is split, and from its splitting grows the thing you hate. We lost our land. The danger is here, for two men are not as lonely and perplexed as one. And from this first we, there grows a still more dangerous thing. I have a little food, plus I have none. If from this problem the sum is we have a little food, the thing is on its way, the movement has direction. Only a little multiplication now. In this land, this tractor, are ours. The two men squatting in a ditch, the little fire the side meat's doing, in a single pot, the silent, stone-eyed women. Behind, the children listening with their souls to words their minds do not understand. The night draws down. The baby has a cold. Here, take this blanket. It's wool. It was my mother's blanket. Take it for the baby. This is the thing to bomb. This is the beginning from high to we. And the great owners who must lose their land in an upheaval, the great owners with access to history, with eyes to read history and to know the great fact, when property accumulates in too few hands, it is taken away. And that companion fact, when a majority of the people are hungry and cold, they will take by force what they need. And the little screaming fact that sounds through all history, repression works only to strengthen and knit the repressed. The great owners ignored the three cries of history. The land fell into fewer hands, the number of the dispossessed increased, and every effort of the great owners was directed at repression. The money was spent for arms, for gas to protect the great holdings, and spies were sent to catch the murmuring of revolt so that it might be stamped out. The changing economy was ignored, plans for the change ignored, and only means to destroy revolt were considered, while the causes of revolt went on.
A message in a Boone's Farm bottle. Some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners. By email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. From Haas in Virginia City, we hear former U.S. drone sensor operator Brandon Bryant admits he couldn't stand himself for his participation in the country's drone program for 6 years, firing on targets whose identities often went unconfirmed. Since 2001, and increasingly under the Obama administration, the U.S. has been carrying out drone strikes against targets believed to be affiliated with terrorist organizations. In countries like Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, and Somalia. The program, which has been shrouded in secrecy, has been routinely criticized for the high number of resultant civilian casualties. Pakistan's Peshawar High Court ruled in 2013 that the attacks constitute a war crime and violate the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Meanwhile, the Obama administration continues to insist that drone warfare is a precise and effective method of combat. According to data collected by the human rights group Reprieve and published last November, attempts to kill 41 targeted individuals across Pakistan and Yemen resulted in the deaths of some 1,147 people. Often a kill requires multiple strikes, the group noted. Bryant, who worked as a sensor operator, manning drones, cameras, and other intelligence gathering hardware, worked from an air base in Nevada. The operator, who left his post in 2011, spoke harshly of the program and the leadership responsible for approving it. There was no oversight. I just know that the inside of the entire program was diseased, and people need to know what happens to those that were on the inside, he told RT's Anissa Nawai. People need to know the lack of oversight, the lack of accountability that happens. Bryant decried the black hole putrid system that is either going to crush you or you're going to conform to it, and apologized to families of victims whose death he was responsible for. By his estimation, he helped kill some 1,626 people. I couldn't stand myself for doing it, he added. I'm sorry that the mistake happened. I'm doing everything I can to prevent further mistakes from happening.
A message in a Boone's Farm bottle. Some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegram.
And now, your 6 o'clock news moment of Zen. Close your eyes and imagine John Stewart, Stephen Colbert, Brian Williams, Peter Jennings, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Matt Lauer, Rachel Maddow, telling the truth. Breathe in, breathe out.
A former Guantanamo Bay prison guard and Marine explained in details what makes him believe three problematic detainees were killed at CIA Black Site in Guantanamo, and their death was covered up as a triple suicide. Army Staff Sergeant Joseph Hickman was on duty at the notorious prison camp when the three men died and insists the official version of events is impossible, he told Vice News. The three men were Salah Ahmad al-Salami, 37, from Yemen, Manny Shaman al-Yukabi, 30, from Saudi Arabia, and Yasser Talal al-Zarani, 22, also from Saudi Arabia. None of them had been charged with any crime. He explained in an incendiary interview with Vice News that the three men would have had to have committed suicide at exactly the same time in a cell block where guards check on detainees every 4 minutes. They would have had to all three tie their hands and feet together, shove rags down their throats, put a mask over their face, made a noose, hung it from the ceiling on the side of the cell block just at the same time. Hickman added that an inspection of the detainee cells just a few hours before they supposedly killed themselves revealed nothing that they might have used to kill themselves, such as nooses, rags, or shoelaces. The former Marine, who first joined up in 1985 and for a while was in a unit attached to the NSA, has been trying to put the nightmare of working at Camp Delta behind him. But when he saw on TV that another inmate had hung himself, he decided to face up to what he had witnessed. He has written a book, Murder at Camp Delta, which he hopes will eventually lead to the truth. I can't name names. I keep it vague at the end for that reason. I say it was murder. This is the reason why, he said.
Your 6 o'clock news moment of Zen. Close your eyes and imagine John Stewart, Stephen Colbert, Brian Williams, Peter Jennings, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Matt Lauer, Rachel Maddow, telling the truth. Breathe in. Breathe out.
Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown at the end of the empire. Duluth is a microbrew of what is going on everywhere where the people fight to have some sort of say and leave it to the outlaws to come up with something. Leave it to the guys in the jails and carrying skateboards leaning up against the light pole at 2 a.m. to come up with something. It's the home of Piker McNugget, Carol Kopecky, Frosty Pine, Winnie Bloodfeather, some 23 Toivonens, Diamond Griffin, and Penny Jones. Families from Minneapolis and St. Paul and St. Peter and Mankato and Des Moines thundering up Interstate 35, hit full throttle on Friday afternoon, accelerating past Hinckley and Sandstone, past Pine City, Barnum, Cloquet, to get away, to let their hair down, to get bugs and branches in their hair. You turn your phone to vibrate or heave it into the ditch, grenade style. Change your radio from WCCO to the Moose. Up and up and around and over the hill, and there it is, the view, Lake Superior, the big lake. And there's the lift bridge in Morgan Park and New Page Paper Plant. The bridges to Superior, Wisconsin, the bay, the big boats. Turn right to Canal Park for the tourists. Turn left uphill for those who have already decided to stay. Duluth is big burritos and apricot wheat beer and a parade to celebrate cold weather. Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings, like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 a.m, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops, and it's adventure, and it's being able to be yourself. But Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite, guns, tattoos, bowling, brawls, Bigfoot and ball games. It's laser tag. It's the bomb. It's the gold. We continue our story, the inauguration parade for Mayor Mary Pine, and watching the parade, Penny Jones. Penny Jones was going to kill the new liberal mayor, but it seemed someone got there before him. Penny climbed onto the flatbed and found himself the one helping her as she struggled for life. Last week, he was busy with one of his first aid classes, and now we find him in the cabaret bar. Penny is nursing his beard, thinking about practically everything in the whole universe there is to even think about. And who would know that? Who the hell would even care what Penny thinks or feels?
Boy Scouts. Oh, well, yeah, he'd have to quit that sometime, but they counted on him. Loved his first aid stories about how he worked as an EMT for the county for years and how he got interested in emergency procedures. Born alone. I was. We all are, he thought. Yeah. Boy Scouts. Firemen. They take fire seriously. How come we never come running when some guy is sitting home alone, depressed? He thought about his wife and kids and reached for his glass, touched it, then let go. He reached for the knife. He'd been thinking for a long time about killing Mary Pine. Somebody had to. She was going to turn the whole place into the People's Republic of the Arrowhead, just like McBugger said. He could have killed her. Climbed up on the float right now and stabbed her in the heart, run away like the guy who killed the nigger lover. He'd be getting rid of all that, the whole bunch gone. But when she got so close and was talking right to him, and he could see her face and the flowers in her hair, didn't even think of the knife. Maybe Wolf and Fuff were right about her, but how could he go along with all that, telling what doctors to go to, taking our guns, jamming global warming down everyone's throats, and the kids, telling them all these lies in their history books. That's one. That's just too much to take. Those Boy Scouts and their leaders, too, they seemed to like it when it was Penny's time to stop by again. Gary, the rest of White Pine, walked up to the stage and knocked fists. The other guys were already done. They shuffled off as the comedian stepped up on the other side. Penny elbowed his lighter onto the floor, reached over to get it, and hit his head on the table. Thought about it again, started to get angry. "Sorry," he said, shooting up a hand. The comedian fixed his hand to his brow to be able to see into the dark. Well, he got angry because of the stupid people who went to the wrong address over in Superior, not Duluth. Same street name, same number, wrong freaking town. His father cried. His brothers and sisters and uncles and grandparents cried. Penny put on the red towel, the superhero cape his father had made for him with a safety pin. He ate 2 bags of candy that night so he could save his mother, save everyone. The comedian pointed into the crowd. "Hey, We have the hero here tonight. He pointed the flashlight he kept on his bar stool to point out celebrities and hecklers. He shined it on Penny. Please, stand up, stand up, ladies and gentlemen. Pencil Jones. Penny half stood, a faint scattered applause, and quickly sat. Penny's mother ended up losing that eye because it rolled all the way down the street, his sister told him, and it was his fault and dark by the time anybody got there and stuff like that. He reached into his pocket, pulled out the eye patch he sometimes wore in honor of her. He put it on. Couldn't see the stage. He dragged it around his head to the other eye. Now he couldn't see the bar or the front door. He put it back in his pocket. And in heaven's name, who are the public enemies? Are they France, England, Germany, or hunger, coal, and nakedness? Oh, excuse me, this is my Northland tour. The comedian put up quote marks. Swamp people, let's talk about killing animals. A few clapped. I'm home. The comedian took a drag on his cigarette and a drink from the glass on the stool as the lights dimmed even more. The official version. Penny put up more quote marks, raising his hands inches from the table. Who really did it? Why? Her dream. What was she doing? What was she doing? What the hell did she think she was doing? She was better than that effing McNugget goddamn bastard, though. He wasn't any different than the rest of his family. The comedian stopped for a moment. The old people sniffed the smoky air like rabbits wondering when to bolt. Titty joke, someone hollered from inside the dark, and the comedian ran the flashlight around the room like a searchlight in a prison yard. Penny put his air quotes down and touched his lips. He sipped his beer and smoked a dead butt. But he didn't have time for a life and family. Maybe he did. Maybe he could have. Penny raised up in his chair, half stood, and the comedian stopped to look at him. Pencil Jones, everyone. He shined his light in Penny's face. It's okay. Penny raised one hand. Just looking for the clock. It's okay. The comedian looked at his wrists. 8:52. Penny raised his hand again as he sat. Thank you. Thanks. He raised his hand again.
And that's the news from Duluth. Where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
The new American dream means never having to say some question or idea is not valid. We're allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. There's no hidden black military budget. There are no UFO files Americans cannot see. No JFK documents that will not be opened during our lifetimes. No destroyed RFK murder photos by the LA police. No evidence from Ground Zero taken away before we can even look at it. We're not the USSR of the 1960s. This is supposed to be America. That is our dream. To become America, the new America, the real hope of the world. We have a dream of bringing the United States politicians, journalists, and generals who have brought about this long 12-year war and debacle to trial and put it on TV just like OJ every afternoon so every American can watch. Just like the McCarthy hearings and the JFK funeral procession. What we need is a new American dream, not of homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. Right now, we live on lies. We subsist on lies, but it's not really living. 9/11 was an inside job. Bush, Cheney, Rice, Powell, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, Obama, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, they all know that. What we need in America is a truth commission like they had in South Africa to heal their broken country. We need to put certain people on the stand, and we need to be allowed to ask questions. Our country is surely broken as well. The troops are not protecting us. That's someone's spin on the day's news, somebody's advertising slogan, someone else's sermon. The troops serve the empire. They're not heroes. They kill and plunder for the empire. American bases overseas serve nobody but the empire. The heroes in our country are the protesters. The ones who go face to face with the empire. Those in the plowshares movement, for one example. You have to know that Barack Obama knows the whole truth about the 9/11 attacks. He's complicit. He's lied. He's continued the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan based on a lie. And he knows he's lying. Lied right to our faces on national television when he said Osama bin Laden had been killed and buried at sea. Osama bin Laden was buried at sea, and Jessica Lynch was rescued heroically. The USA does not torture. Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. George Bush won the 2000 election. And see, there is a plane there in that hole in Shanksville. It went all the way into that hole. And no, there's no blood and no bodies and no luggage scattered or plane parts. And Osama bin Laden was buried at sea. Remember the anthrax letters, which said, "Are you afraid?" Those were not written with a rock and chisel like Fred Flintstone from the recesses of some cave in Afghanistan. Those letters came from persons within our own government, like a horror movie, and the killer is in the same house with us. These killers are right here with us. And they want us to be afraid. We cannot be afraid. Thank you, and good night, Mike.
Good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And so good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Solov. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.